I'm going to pick a number, 160 milliamperes of total grid current for both tubes, and you did it for 5 solid seconds, I think it's a 50% probability you're going to burn up the grids if you did that. But what you've run into for a very brief period of time, I doubt it. I'm a little bit surprised if Tentec, they normally do a very good engineering job, a little bit surprised if they haven't put some kind of a protection circuit that monitors grid current and then goes into some kind of a protect mode when it sees excessive grid current, because to injure those tubes could be a little bit expensive. The ALC circuit, let me drop. To really use a linear amplifier correctly, you'd like to make sure that the peaks of your audio are not overdriving it a whole lot, where you start making splatter, where you start making flat topping of the actual envelopes of sideband signal that you're transmitting. And so the way many rigs are set up is that there's some form of peak detector network, quite often in the output circuit of the amplifier. It samples that RF energy, and if it exceeds a certain peak value, that gets fed back by the ALC line to your exciter transmitter, and adjusts its ALC accordingly. In other words, cuts back the gain during those portions of your speech where you're shouting real loud, so to speak, so that you're not doing splattering. So properly set up, those ALC circuits can drastically increase the linearity of what you transmit. You'd be amazed how many DX stations completely abandon that. They want to have the splatter. They want to have the maximum power output, because their definition of success is they look at the bird watt meter and they want to peg the needle on the bird watt meter when they're using the afterburner. And that's a philosophy that's a little bit severe by my point of view, and can make an awful lot of splatter, and you can make yourself pretty unpopular with your nearby neighbors frequency-wise, if you know what I mean. I wonder what's your experience with ALC circuits on either solid-state or tube-type drivers into afterburners, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'll make it brief because it's getting late, so we want to get on. Let me just say one more thing. I got a bulletin from IMAC some years ago that there had been a number of tube failures. Believe it or not, yes, 3TX800, good, great tube. I have, they're old, my rig, but still going strong. One of the mandatory improvements that they had was a resistor to protect the tube and power supply in the event of any kind of arc over, including high voltage arc over. And what they recommended was putting in series with the B plus lead that goes to the RF choke a 60 ohm 50 watt resistor. And that was because, like I say, I would bet the later amplifiers had that included. But if it isn't, that is a heck of a good piece of investment, Dick. All right. With that, as far as the ALCs and all, it works really great if you properly set it up. Of course, it's a simple, straightforward circuit. The ALC is basically been in all those rigs, I'm sure, and a grid, what they call grid trip, is also built into that, Dick. So got a good amplifier, basically. There. I like them very much. Go ahead.
I'm going to give you a couple of words, Bob, on that 60-ohm resistor. If you made the mistake of meshing your C2 capacitor, your loading capacitor, in other words, meshing it, in other words, going to a very large amount of picofarads, because you've got the plates fully engaged with each other, so to speak, and you resonate the final stage, you therefore can get an extremely large voltage swing, RF voltage swing, on the plate of the tube. And if your tube has not been debonicled, and that's another whole tune-up procedure for these tubes, there is a small possibility that the tube will arc over because of instantaneous very high voltage, because of very light loading in resonance. If the tube does arc over, and this is the plasmas now that we've been discussing for a couple of weeks, and we're all learning more and more about plasma, you create a plasma inside that tube, you create an arc between the plate and the grid. That arc is an extremely low negative resistance conducting material when it happens. and therefore all of the stored energy in your B-plus capacitors, you got something like 3,500 volts on the power supply, probably backed up with 10 microfarads. That's a lot of joules of energy. And once you strike an arc in that tube, those joules of energy get dumped into that arc, and you're splattering materials inside that tube. You're melting down the chunks of metal and electroplating it all over the sides of that ceramic insulator inside. Arcing within a tube is a very destructive process, and you want to avoid it. I'm not trying to scare you. I'm just telling you the worst-case situations here, just to make sure you can avoid the situation. By having that 60-ohm resistor, now, instead of thousands of amperes of instantaneous current flowing from your B-plus capacitors into that arc, it's now being dropped through that 60-ohm resistor, and therefore the damage done in the tube is cut down to a small fraction of 1% of what it would have been had that resistor not be present if you have an arc within the tube. So now you know a little bit more about...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now you know a little bit more about the philosophy of using a dropping resistor between your power supply and a high power amplifier to be a belt and suspenders way of protecting the tubes. So we'll be discussing this more, Bob, but you're going to have more questions on that amplifier, and you got a beautiful piece of hardware there. Matt, we're going to go over to you in a hurry before going over to the mailbag. KC2, Yankee Delta Tango. Go right ahead with your question, Matt. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2YDT. Okay, very good. I have one question which I don't believe you guys will be able to help with that much, but we'll give it a shot. With the portable radio that I have now, it's a no-name radio, has full keyboard on it and everything. I can't access DTMF tones for some reason. They seem to be completely off. I looked in the manual, and I see nothing in the manual about DTMF. You guys have any suggestions to the way to just like not have it? Or is there some other terminology that I should look for in the manual for DTMF?
DTMF, dual tone multi-frequency or something like that is what it stands for, also called DL, DL private line, was the original words for it back in the early days of Motorola. Some of the older rigs or some of the rigs that you can buy, portable handy talkies, if you didn't buy the option which installs the printed circuit board that creates the DTMF tones, the possibility exists that they're not there. That's not a showstopper. There's a lot of manufacturers in the past, and I presume they still exist, for what are so-called aftermarket tone generators, aftermarket PL or DTMF generators. To add that inside of your handy talkie is a relatively easy thing to do. The early versions, for instance, of all of the ICOM IC2AT, I own about five of these things. The most reproduced handy talkie portable radio on planet Earth is probably the ICOM IC2AT. That was the design. Let me drop.
Vic, he's talking about touch tone. DTMF is touch tone, not PL.
Oh, now, if there's no touch tones on the front panel of the handy talkie, you don't have that. And can you install a speaker mic that has built-in tones itself? Let's find out what's the model number of the radio we're talking about here, Matt. What is the brand name and model number of your portable radio? KC2YDT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. It's... like I said before, it's a no-name radio, no brand name. It's from this company that calls himself Atlas, but it's not an, the old Atlas radio. And for some for whatever reasons, you know, it has the full keyboard on the front side. It says it's a fully programmable radio, and as far as programming the frequencies in, that's not a problem. It has a full keyboard on it, the full touch tone numbers and everything. But for some reason, when I try and hold the transmit down and punch in the node number, it does not register like my Yaitzer does. When I hold the transmit and punch in the numbers, I'll hear, you know, the tone of each number which I'm putting in, almost like a phone. But, you know, like I said, it's very odd. It doesn't seem to either be on it or even, or to not even have that feature.
Rich N2EO, I wonder if you've heard of that particular no-name Atlas sold radio, which has got the touch power pad on the front cover, but it doesn't generate the tones. I wonder if you've heard about that, and I wonder if there is a solution. Maybe I wonder if you could add an external speaker mic, which has a tone generator inside, although finding one that's thoroughly compatible doesn't sound easy. N2AO, if you got some info on this one, Rich, go ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick N2AO. I really don't know. We were discussing this a few days ago. Matt bought that radio. It has nothing to do with Atlas Radio, which was in business, which was a spin-off of Swan Radio in Oceanside, California. It's just somebody using that name. The radio we bought came from China. It's a no-name radio. The feeling I get is that the keypad is just programming the radio. It probably does not have tone capability in it. That's my guess.
KYDT, for a quick comment. The radio is made in USA. It's not from China. It has the full FCC license and everything on the back of it. It's just very odd.
Just because it has FCC approval, which maybe is required before you can import that and sell it in the United States, doesn't necessarily mean it's been manufactured here. Let me pass this open to the net. So, as I see it, Matt's problem is that he has a no-name brand radio sold by the Atlas company, but it wasn't Atlas, which has a touch tone pad on the front panel, which allows him to program the radio, but it does not generate the touch tone tones that are normally used for doing certain kinds of repeater operations. Anyone familiar with that radio or have a suggestion for Matt, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. It's beginning to look like we don't have anybody on frequency with knowledge of that particular radio because it was an inexpensive buy and an unknown brand name. And you believe it's United States manufactured because of the FCC markings. That's not likely, Matt. To manufacture things in the United States these days is very expensive. The majority of all of our calculators and handy talkies and cell phones and whatever are manufactured in Southeast Asia, where the labor is much, much cheaper. And I think there's a high probability your radio was manufactured offshore. And so there probably are ways of adding that function to the radio. If it was a PL tone you were lacking, there are aftermarket PL generators you can add to the radio. Is there a way you can add the touch tones? I'm guessing it's possible. I'm guessing it's not going to be easy. You may be ahead of the game to just not use that handy talkie when you need touch tone capability. Use one of your other handy talkies is about the best I can suggest. And as you research that further, as you find out more about it, Matt, please come back and tell us what you find. Mel, let's go over to your mailbag. Sorry we've kept you so late. And what's the burning questions this week? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Pacific, Thomas 996.
Take if I could say that to you.
Rich was the second person. Who's the person who said he's got a comment? Give us your call letter's name and you go right ahead with your comment.
Yeah, it's AC2AZ, it's Bob. Matt, I think you can buy second market DTMF encoders that just play to a speaker and just put that right up against your mic, and that'll work as well. The whole idea is that the tones are encoded in audio. You don't need to have a direct connection. But anyway, are you the Matt from Larkfield?
KC2, I think. If that, the Larkfield Yahoo group, I believe I'm on that, if that's the transmitter one. If not, no, I'm not the Matt from Larkfield.
Comment, Dick.
Okay, before we turn it over to John, first, AC2AZ, Bob, roughly how many dollars and where is that tone generator you're describing, Bob? Go ahead.
If you pick up an issue of Nuts and Bolts magazine, you could probably find one in there. I see them all the time, and, you know, you can adapt it to a little speaker or something and then just play it right into the mic, and that'll work.
Roughly how many dollars do you think it costs, Bob?
I would guess under 30.
Very good. John, KC2WGB, tell us what you know about this.
I think I was just going to suggest for Matt to contact CDL, Andy. He could probably help him answer that question. I think that's the way to go.
Another very good question, suggestion. So Andy, the B2CDL, who's the guy who runs the tune-up clinics for years and years at all the Limar functions, and most likely he will be active this coming weekend at the Ham Radio University that will take place at Briarcliff College on Sunday. And there's going to be an award ceremony there, and the TechNet is going to get an award for the Technical Service Award presented by the President of the League. Alrighty, I'm Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead with your mailbag, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Got a quick one, Dick. Got to give you an interesting... Almost went blind here, had a quick accident. I want to tell you guys about it.
Okay, right after the mailbag, we're going to go over to that piece of information, Rich. So please hang in there, I hope you can. Mel, go right ahead with the mailbag.
Okay, this is K2KEY, and I'm just looking through some really brief ones. Here's one that reoccurs quite an often, I guess, from a lot of the newer people coming into amateur radio, and it's about the number of the articles that are published in QSC project articles, and that they say that if you, you know, go to the different companies that offer pre-made circuit boards, and or semi-kits, what is the possibility that you're going to get this project to work as described in QST? In other words, can it be duplicated? Like I say, these are not full kits. They will supply you, in many cases, with a printed circuit board already cut, ready to go, but you then purchase the individual components. And what do you think the success rate is, Dick? Have you ever tackled any of these projects that have been showing up in the recent years? Over.
I only know of one exception. Way back in 1975, where an article appeared in QST Magazine, a construction article, which had a number of significant errors, where reproducing the results would have been difficult. I only know of one. As such, I have reason to believe that the laboratory at League headquarters, run by Zach Lau, among others, Whiskey One Victor Tango, a very smart guy, I'd like to believe that each of those articles that appear for construction have been reviewed. The person who wrote the original article was pretty well interviewed, if you know what I mean. And with one other exception, and that is for a number of decades, the April 1st issue would have a number of intentional comical articles that looked like they were serious construction, but as you dug a little bit deeper, you can find they had unusual words. They had made-up words for the phenomena and whatever. So the April 1st issue in past decades had some crazy articles in there that were not real. But I think they've ceased doing that. They got an awful lot of flack on that from time to time. Every so often somebody would say, gee, I got sucked up by that article and went and bought the hardware and tried duplicating it. Let me drop. So I'm convinced that a person who is skilled in the art will have 98% probability of getting success out of the articles. Obviously now there's some catchwords that I just said, skilled in the art. If you're a person who is just being introduced to electronics for the first time, and you don't yet know how to read the color code, you're not quite sure what an ohm meter is telling you, you're not really familiar with using a digital voltmeter or a voltohm-milliammeter, you're not quite sure the proper ways of measuring current and voltage, you might not have bought the right parts, you may have thought you bought the right parts and didn't. If you're sufficiently neophyte, sufficiently uninformed on technology and electronics in general, yes, these articles could give you some grief. So a person skilled in the art, in other words, a person who knows how to use a digital voltmeter, maybe knows how to use an oscilloscope, has a power supply, has got a good set of tools, has done a couple of previous projects, I would guess that almost none of those people have any trouble. So I guess we're really discussing education here, Mel, and that's the whole reason why you've got a mailbag. A number of the people are going through the process of getting the education, therefore they're asking these questions. And in which case, our guarantee of success is not quite as high. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. All right. Let's see. As far as projects go, give a suggestion to people just coming into ham radio. I know it's very tempting, some of these nice little gadgets that they have to add on to your station, little monitors, little controllers, and things like that. I guess the best thing I would say is to start with the simplest one, so-called to get your feet wet, and see how your results come out. In other words, get a feel, see if you are comfortable, or in fact, you'll get practice in soldering. You know, there's an art to soldering. If you don't solder properly, you know, onto the PC board, if it's going to come out as what we call cold solder joints, or you're going to, you know, pile on too much solder so that possibility, you know, with the way the boards are made, doesn't give you much clearance, that you wind up with short circuits. Therein lies experience, basically. So I guess starting with a simple circuit to begin with, I would think is the best way to go, and then I'll give another suggestion, but do you agree with that, over?
I sure do, Mel. On top of that, whenever you're going through a learning curve, there's going to be mistakes. And the assumption that you've chosen an article or a device that you want to build, and assume that it doesn't have an expensive part, like what we were discussing earlier, a 3CX800A5 tube. I'm not sure, but maybe that particular vacuum tube these days is $400, brand new, $450. Wouldn't surprise me. In which case, you got to be careful. That's an expensive part. But as long as you've chosen a article that has inexpensive components, if at first it doesn't work, it's not a disaster. Usually, it's not going to create smoke and flames and whatever. So, you have to accept the fact that when you're in the learning curve, some mistakes are going to be made, and the mistake itself is a very educational process. So with the right attitude, where success is not 100% guaranteed, I mean, a person could ask every single person he knows that knows anything about electronics, research the living daylights out of a project, so that when he finally launches into it, he's guaranteed success. That's one approach. But it may be an expensive approach in time. In other words, now you're going to spend a whole lot of time doing a whole lot of research, whereas if you just bought the $4 worth of parts, put them together the first time, it didn't quite work, you got on the TechNet, you described the problem, and we told you move this connection and worry about that cold solder joint, and now it's working, you may get a more performance per time, if you know what I mean. So there's various attitudes you can have as you're going through this learning curve. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hey, that's a very good point you made, Dick, but I'll make one more point. If you're going to build any kind of little project, I have found you start texting immediately. All you need is Dick says, using a VOM, in fact, good experience to get to understand the meter, taking a simple VOM, you solder a connection, first you pin before you solder the connection, text from, say, ground potential to the point where you're going to solder and see what a resistance reading you're getting, put the component in, and then see what happens. If you all of a sudden get a very low resistance reading, the possibility looked at you possible have a short there in your soldering. So rather than put a whole project together and then start looking, going crazy, it's easy to test as you go along as to, you know, the possibility that there's something malfunctioning initially. Have you gone through that procedure, Dick, in your building? Over.
Yeah, once you put a circuit together that's got resistors, capacitors, battery, meter, transistors, and whatever, and if the circuit was properly designed, defined such that under normal operating conditions, you know how many volts should appear on that emitter of the transistor and how many volts should appear on the collector. And so once you put the thing together, if you're not getting the results that you like, and you properly use your digital voltmeter, and go and measure each one of those voltages at each one of those points, that kind of a troubleshooting procedure is very educational. If you've got a transistor that's defective or not properly soldered in or soldered in upside down or whatever, and you go and measure the voltages that are supposed to be present at each one of those terminals, and you find a significant difference, you've got to be careful now. If the schematic tells you that it's supposed to be 4.5 volts, and you measure 4.42, well, that's close enough. That's in the right ballpark. That's within the normal tolerance, if you know what I mean. But once you understand that it's supposed to be 4.5 volts, and you measure 0.5 volts instead of 4.5, you know something is wrong. And now you start doing a little bit further search around there with your digital voltmeter and probe the resistors and capacitors and transistors around there to see if there's a common denominator representing an open circuit, a cold solder joint, a short circuit to ground, and so on. So even if the circuit doesn't work and you're willing to now spend a little bit of time measuring the voltages and correlating them to what they should be, that again is an extremely educational process. When I was doing early television repair, that procedure worked awfully well for me. Divide and conquer is what I called it, or signal tracing. If there's a way you can pour a signal through the circuit, and now with some kind of an audio amplifier and a loudspeaker, you touch the various places with a capacitive coupling.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You touch the various circuits, the various portions that the signal is supposed to flow through. And now with your audio amplifier, capacitively coupled probe, and loudspeaker, you see the signal getting stronger or weaker as you work your way forward. By signal tracing, you can get some strong clues. So failure of a circuit is not necessarily bad news. The troubleshooting procedure is something that any of us doing any serious electronic work should learn. It's a valuable skill to have, and so you might be acquiring that skill a lot faster than you think if you did make a mistake unintentionally when you built your first circuit, but then you went and did the troubleshooting. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, good idea. I find that the best thing is if you're building a project, you're starting with the power supply. Good place to start. You build a power supply or however they explain to you whether you have a battery circuit and all. And you start at the point where, you know, the first stage or the first part of the project is to be powered up with a supply. In other words, you make sure whatever the power supply is, whether it's a battery or, you know, a little transformer with some rectifiers and all, that you get that working so you can power up as you're going along. After, like I say, what you can do before you can power up is, as Dick and I were just really alluding to, you can make tests, resistive tests. You have to also learn, again, start analyzing the circuit and get an idea of saying, gee, is it possible I can get such a low resistance measurement at this point? And you have to evaluate and see whether this passes, you know, the components in that circuit and whether or not it's possible that, you know, one of them would be giving you such a low resistive value on that point. So analysis, I guess, is, as Dick said, in repairing TVs, divide and conquer, was very successful also in my situation. Did the same thing, went through the same routine, and in fact, when your mind gets set to do things properly and analyze before you touch, analysis is almost, I'd say, maybe 90% of the job. You'd be amazed how, you know, many times just go almost right to the trouble without fooling around with other all kinds of things and looking to get yourself into more problems. So I think analysis really of understanding what you're doing, what the circuit is.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
One thing that's good to know is that in the early days of all the Heath kits that I built, on a number of occasions, before you plugged it in, before you applied the power to the circuit, Heath kit would have two or three critical portions of the circuit where they would tell you to measure the number of ohms between that point and ground, or between that point and B+. By measuring the number of ohms before you apply the power on certain kinds of circuits can avoid an awful lot of grief. In many cases, if you put the ohm meter across the two terminals where the power supply is about to go, and if your ohm meter measures 1 ohm or less, and you're about to apply 15 volts to that, you know that by Ohm's law, something is wrong, that 15 amperes would be flowing into a circuit when you expect only a 5 or 50 milliamps to be flowing, if you know what I mean. So simple ohm meter tests at various portions of the circuit before you apply power could save an awful lot of grief. If, for instance, you know that the emitter of this particular transistor has a 150 ohm resistor to ground, and you simply touch one lead of your ohm meter to the emitter of the transistor and the other lead of the ohm meter to ground, and if you measure something in the vicinity of 150 ohms, which is determining the bias for that transistor, that's a good thing to know, and it tells you that portion is properly wired. So by looking at the schematic and making some logical conclusions as to where you can make ohm meter tests before you apply power could be very useful. Let me drop. If you've got a circuit that's about to be plugged into the 110-volt line, to put your ohm meter across those two prongs before you excite your circuit, before you really plug it in, put your ohm meter across there is a very valuable thing to do to see if you get a reasonable number of ohms. The one slight catch to what I just said is that if the very first thing that your power cord is going to see is a transformer, it might be a step-down transformer that steps the 120 volts AC down to 12 volts, because your circuit includes a power supply. That's the one exception, because the transformer has just the right impedance when 60 cycle voltage waveform is placed onto its primary winding, but your ohm meter might show an extremely small number of ohms. A transformer acts very different to DC compared to AC, alternating current versus direct current, and your ohm meter only does a DC current measurement. However, a poor man's ohm meter would be a, let me pick a number, a 50-watt light bulb in series with the 110-volt line, and now you plug that into your circuit. If there's something wrong with your circuit so that it acts like a dead short, the 50-watt light bulb will simply light, and the current has automatically been limited. So there's various ways that you can protect your circuit the first time you power it up so as not to do further damage if there was some kind of an error you didn't catch. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, sounds like an excellent suggestion. And I'll say, don't get scared. We don't want to chase you off from building any small projects or starting small and working your way up. I would suggest definitely, if you're interested in amateur radio and experimentation, electronics, and possibility even have it back of your mind that this is a fascinating field, which it is, and possibility you'd like to study some of portion of whether it be directly electrical engineering like Dick and myself, or some other form of it requiring some of the technical knowledge like in the computer sciences, and to get a good in-depth, what I'm trying to bring out, to really get a good in-depth idea what's going on. There is nothing like practical experience and hands-on. I know of many people, they were amazed that because I was a few years ago teaching in New York at a college, and we had a thing called, part of the electrical engineering course called metrology, the use of test instruments. And you say, gee, in this day and age, people still use a test instrument? Yes, they are. In some aspects, there is no replacement built for that old-fashioned. I know people laugh at me seeing it on a 260 Simpson VOM, Dick, over.
Simpson and triplet. 630, 737, I forget the model numbers, but Simpson and triplet made two extremely popular volt-ohm milliammeters, a completely passive meter where the only battery inside is to run the ohm meter scale. Whereas your digital voltmeter usually has a 9-volt battery, and if it's in good shape, they are also very effective. Now, a young person who is a little bit interested in science and technology in general, and he's trying to decide what he's going to do with his life, and because everybody is fiddling with computers, it's very easy to say, I want to be a computer scientist. I want to get into computer science. Unfortunately, everybody else is doing the same thing, and you're going to get an awful lot of competition. And what many companies do when it comes to computer engineers and software engineers, they consider them a dime a dozen. They hire them when they need them and lay them off when they don't need them for the next month, if you know what I mean, because they're so easy to hire back again. So if you go into computer science, although it's very useful, you're going to be into a lot of competition. However, if by way of ham radio, let me drop... By way of ham radio, you decide to pursue radio and wireless technology, because essentially all of the schools in the United States, by MEL and MI standards, they are doing what I believe is a rather poor job of teaching that art and science. And for reasons that MEL and I don't understand, not very many students have the gumption to go into that field. If by way of your ham radio experience, you decide to pursue wireless technology, Mel and Dick have been treated royally for the last 40 years because we have acquired that skill, and 90% of that skill did not come from the colleges I went to. They gave me a lot of good background, no two ways about it. They gave me a sheepskin, in other words, they gave me a diploma that says I can be hired as an engineer. That's the good news. But the real working knowledge, day to day, 90% of it did not come from the school. It came from my ham radio experience. As such, it's a relatively rare art and science. Lots of companies have to farm out those technologies because they haven't got it in-house, and they don't even think it exists within the United States. And so they're farming it out of company, in many cases out of country, in order to get the technology to build the radio, to build the antenna, to design the circuitry that fits into that small little portable box these days. If you've got that skill, you've got a guaranteed job. So of, by way of ham radio, the education that you will get from it will give you a lot of enjoyment because you know this relatively rare art and science, and you'll be treated very well. They'll basically throw money at you. I'm exaggerating a little bit. I wonder if you've experienced something similar to that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, like I say, it's surely gave me a comfortable career over the years to the point where, you know, I was able to afford a decent, good, you know, I say, not a rich, far from being a rich person, but a good, decent middle-class life, you know, with that put children through schools and everything, college pay, be able to pay that, and, like you say, have a home, all of this. So it's been good to me, I will honestly say. Unfortunately, I don't want to get into the educational system. You know, that I've had issues with ever since the daughters, the girls were in school, how education is handled. I've had a couple run-in with a couple of teachers because the methods that they were using, I basically looked at them cross-eyed. I don't know where you came up with so many things, but because there were complaints when I actually tutored the girls myself on how I think it should be done, and they became instantly were able to grasp, whereas before they were literally sitting there in puzzlement. I mean, let's drop. As Dick was just saying, the practical experience that we've got, and we started with practical experience before we were anywhere near a college level. We were putting things together and understanding, and I'll say, what could you really accomplish as teenagers? And putting together simple circuits like I just were talking about now. It was a lot different in those days. We punched chassis. We did things like that. It was a completely different form of electronics. However, I will say this much, that we were able to make a few dollars as teenagers fixing radios, television sets, and things like that. But the cravat, as they say, that was when we got to the college level, it seemed to fit right in that we had some kind of heads up. I highly recommend that, don't worry, nothing like Dick says, nothing's going to blow up or explode if you're building something with a 9-volt battery and you make a serious mistake. I'm sure it's not going to cost a fortune. Like Dick says, but I'll say another word about 3CX800s. In fact, I just got a thing here, but let's just say cover that much, and then we'll go on, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I think you're going to really enjoy this particular hobby if you're just getting into it. I know of very few hobbies that are more educational, because ham radio includes power supplies, audio circuits, IF circuits, RF circuits, microwave circuits, transmission lines, antennas, electronics in general, and the use of a volt-ohm milliammeter allows you to troubleshoot an air conditioner, a refrigerator, an electric stove, in most of the appliances in your house, to have a small amount of electronic knowledge so that you can do minor amounts of testing and repair of the appliance in your house can give you a sense of confidence that's unbelievable in my mind. A lot of the people I know are afraid to change a light bulb for fear that touching a piece of electronics is dangerous, and they're thoroughly dependent on everybody repairing their refrigerator, their air conditioner, their automobile, their lawnmower, whatever. They're dependent on people to do all of that for them. Well, if you've got deep pockets and your time is valuable, that's one approach. Well, the majority of us don't have deep pockets. We'd like to save some money. We'd like to know a little bit about what's going on. We're not sure whether or not somebody is raking us over the coals when that particular repairman says a list of parts as to why that should be the price. And if you're doing the repair yourself, boy, can you save money. Let me give you one quick example. My house is oil heated, and I have been maintaining the oil-fired furnace that heats the house and the oil-fired hot water heater that heats the hot water for the house. And I've been doing that for the last 35 years. My goodness, has that allowed me to save money. I ordered the oil to be delivered, and the last oil delivery was, I think, $3.05 per gallon, whereas everybody who's getting automatic delivery with a contract is paying $3.30. They're paying a lot more money per oil delivery, and the adjustment of the equipment, the maintaining of the equipment. If I get a sudden failure of a heating system at 3 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Day, you wouldn't, no way in hell would you get a service person. I've got the spare parts, and I can fix it. Well, that's happened twice in the last 30 years, so to speak. So it gives me a sense of confidence and a saving of money so I can maintain the material myself. And there's some very good books you can buy on how it works and how to maintain it. It's not rocket science. The number of people you and I know who touch their own oil burner or gas-fired burner are very, very few. With care, it can be done. There's a little bit of danger involved. I'm a little bit more reluctant to tell people to maintain their own gas-fired equipment. But when it comes to oil-fired equipment, it's much more difficult to get in trouble, if you know what I mean. So that's just one of the areas where I maintain the automobiles and the appliances in the house. And the knowledge to do that came from ham radio. K2KEY, K2LIW.
No doubt, same thing on this end here. We said you have a home. If you're independently wealthy, no problem. Get on telephone. You'll find quickly enough somebody to do repairs. If you're in the class like Dick and myself, have a big toolbox. And that's it. I also maintain everything here in this house from the roof down. I've rebuilt everything in this house. This was one of these old, little old house specials when we bought it, and did the A to Z job, basically, just I am giving you credit. You look at me, you get a lot of credit. You sure did a lot of work along with me, your right-hand man. Or maybe I was your right-hand man. All right, anyhow, very good. Let's see. One final word. Funny. I was just thumbing through the files on the 3CX800, and what popped out is from iMac to Tentec, manufacturer of the Titan amplifiers from iMac. It has come to our attention that a number of the 3CX800 tubes that we have found been returned because of failure. Is because the grid dissipation of about 4 watts per tube has easily been exceeded by many of the modern exciters. So, even though, let me drop. So, you have incorporated warning LEDs, an ALC, and a fallback circuitry. These features have been overcome by sheer power along with the failure to observe the warning light and or of the grid current meter. So they have recommended that you add a little simple one of these sounders that, you know, they sell these little, I don't know what the heck they call them, piezo, I think that's the name, piezo or piezo sounders, to add to the light, because the light, as they said here, the light, the LED warning light has been measured at 1.6 pulsating volts. And so if you add this little device, in fact, if you want to make it louder, they tell you you can add one transistor to it, a little circuit, but it will now beep if the system is incorrectly operating. And this was right from iMac to warn people about, like you say, the grids have been decimated in the tubes that we have examined. They are fragile. Believe it or not, the grids are considered fragile and are decimated in many cases. Over.
WA2ARQ. ARQ recognized, and that's good to know. And they're specifically talking about the Tentec amplifiers. So building a sounder in there, so you have not only a visual feedback but an acoustic feedback telling you that you're in a dangerous mode and you better not dwell there for more than a couple of seconds. You've got a conflict of interest when you build a tube like the 3CX800E5. To get really high gain, you've got an extremely closely spaced control grid of a whole lot of very fine wires so that the electrons can be attracted off that cathode but easily can fly through the control grid. So you've got a conflict of interest. To get the tube to have high gain and high performance makes the control grid delicate, and therefore it can't tolerate more than 4 watts of dissipation for any significant period of time. AB2, Alpha Romeo, Quebec. Please start off with your name, sir, and then your comment, K2LAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, this is Whiskey Alpha 2, Alpha Romeo, Quebec, WA2ARQ. Handle is Dick. I've spoken to you before, Dick. You probably have me in your logbook somewhere there. I have a question for you. I'm building a plate modulator with a couple of 6L6s in push-pull, but we're not that far. I have wired up the primary of the, the secondary of the power transformer, 170 volts AC, put it to a switch, and had have it going through a fuse, which I put a 2-amp fuse on, and do not have it attached to anything else, and I figured, let me just plug it in, and it blew the 2-amp fuse. Am I doing something wrong?
Vic, you and I have a confusion going on here. The way you broke in, it sounded like you were adding a comment to the subject that's on the floor right now. We weren't opening it open for more questions at this time. You're on the list, and there's one guy ahead of you, Rich. After that, we're going to pick up with your question. So I led you astray, Vic. We're going to get back to your subject. Rich, N2EO, I know you wanted to continue with your particular subject you brought up earlier. Go right ahead, Rich, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. By the way, the gentleman who just spoke in, man after my own heart, he's probably on 75 meter AM if he's building a modulator. Dick, just want to share something with you. About a half hour ago when I came up here, I had an accident. I averted, by chance, an accident. You know, I restore a lot of the vintage gear from the 60s. I've been doing this for quite a number of years. I got a lot of experience with electronics. Been playing with it since I'm 15 years old, ages 60. What happened was I received an Amico TX62 6 2 meter AM transmitter that I purchased off of eBay, and I fired it up at a low output. Normally, I always change the filter caps out of routine, but I fired it up and was on putting out low power for about a half hour. No sooner did I turn my head that I heard something go off like steam, and it blew a 400 volt 100 microfarad electrolytic, steam rose. It would have went right into my face if I hadn't turned my head literally a second before. So I think the moral to the story is I'm doing the right thing in recapping these radios, but I should really monitor these caps more closely before I change, when I turn the thing on, before I turn it, between the time I turn it off.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
All right, I timed out. Anyway, I put my hand on the filter cap. It was hotter than a firecracker, Dick. And just to reiterate, I know I timed out. That thing went off. It blew up electrolyte and hot steam. And I just turned my head a half a second before. Back to that N2EO.
The filter capacitors that went to this catastrophic failure, Rich, were they the ones that were originally there, or were they the ones that you were replacing? That wasn't clear. Back to you, Rich.
Nope, original caps, 45 years old, in an Amico TX-62 made by the Amico division of Aerotron at the time. I normally, as routine maintenance on all these radios that I restore, I change all these electrolytic caps with brand new ones. I also put on a three-wire cord, and in a lot of cases, they never put fuses. I put a fuse on the back of the radio. So I know I'm doing the right thing. Let me let it recycle. Where I screwed up, and I never thought about it before, I should monitor the old capacitors more closely when I first turn these radios on, between the time I turn them on and the time I change these components. But it was quite an experience. It made a hissing, a loud, like steam, kind of sound of steam coming out of a radiator, and spewed hot steam up. If I hadn't turned my head, I probably would have gotten it right in the eyes.
In the case of electrolytic capacitors that have not been used for a long time, I think I remember hearing about a so-called electrolytic capacitor forming process, sort of a wake-up procedure, where you are using a variac and you slowly increase the voltage on a power supply so that the electrolytic capacitors can come back to life. I wonder if you've heard of anything like that, Rich, and I wonder if that would have helped in this case. Although, in the case of electrolytic capacitors, I think they're only guaranteed to be operational for something like 15 years, after which they're capable of drying out and changing significantly and therefore need replacement. So, have you ever heard of a slow sneak-up forming process, or is that not recommended if you happen to have heard along these lines, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW.
And a quick comment too, Dick.
Okay, Rich first and then John in that order. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Well, I know. I have a variac here. Probably I should have brought it up on the variac. I was anxious to turn it on, and it seemed to be running okay. So it fooled me. But yes, I've heard of that technique. Reform capacitors, but like I say, it's a general rule, and I think I'm doing the right thing. I've been told that I'm wasting money. I don't think I'm wasting money, because if that cap had blown and I was upstairs or out of the house and I left that equipment on, it could have really done some serious damage. As soon as that thing hissed and blew the electrolyte up, I shut the power off and unplugged it. So like I say, on this vintage stuff, I always recommend, I'm right, change out all these electrolytics. Don't try and reform them. Just change them. Change the paper caps. Those paper caps have like an 80 or 90% failure rate that they used in the 50s and before. Little 0.1s, tubular paper caps. I change all that stuff just as a matter of course. And a lot of these radios from that vintage had a two-wire cord, no fuse. I put a fuse in there and a three-wire cord to the ground.
Yeah, by modern standards, it's amazing how many pieces of electronics we've used over the years, Heathkit among others, where there was no third prong creating a chassis ground, a safety. And my Heathkit AR3 receiver, the first Heathkit I built way back in the late 50s, just had a 0.01 disc ceramic capacitor from each side of the AC line going to chassis and a two-prong plug going into the wall. And so a failure of one of those capacitors could easily make the chassis 120 volts AC hot, and I would frequently go down to the basement with my bare feet early in the morning and touch that radio. I do remember on a few occasions touching the chassis and feeling a very uncomfortable tingle, and that's because the two 0.02 disc ceramic capacitors were acting as a voltage divider.